King Nebuchadnezzar was king over Babylon. He had been used by God to conquer the Jews and to take them into captivity for their many, many sins. We can read about that in the book of Daniel. Let's go to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2, and we're going to look at verse 38. You remember the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, and he called for the wise men to interpret the dream, and they could not. He wanted them to not only interpret the dream, but he wanted them to tell him what he dreamed, either because he had forgotten or because he wanted to test the wise men. And they said, you know, we cannot do that. Nobody, no king asked the dream to be revealed and also to be interpreted. You tell us a dream, though, we'll be happy to interpret it. And we all know what happened. But notice in verse 38. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, Nebuchadnezzar, and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. Notice verse 44. We're talking about the 10 toes of the image, or the statue in the dream. Verse 44, and in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom. This is not a spiritual kingdom, brethren. This is a kingdom that's going to take over earthly kingdoms. I hope you understand that. Which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. What are the kingdoms? The Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Greek, the Roman, and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Insomuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain, who is the rock in the Old Testament? The stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and it had broken pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold. The great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. And you can read the details of the vision or the dream, and the stone comes and hits the feet. Now, if the head is Nebuchadnezzar, and the feet are part of the image, and when Christ returns, he hits the feet, then that means that the image is still standing. This has not happened yet. Now, the kingdoms have come, parts of them, but the image is still alive and well. And so what we have is we have Babylon, that is still very much alive and well in the world, because King Nebuchadnezzar is alive and well. And we are in Babylon, and this world that is based on Babylonian customs has holidays that come out of Babylon. Now, let me ask you a question. Tomorrow is going to be what Babylonian holiday? Easter. And we're going to do in the sermon today is we're going to look at the custom of Easter and where it came from, and then we're going to compare that to the true holy days, especially the Feast of Unleavened Bread that we are looking at and observing today. So we're going to look at where Easter came from, and then we're going to compare it to the days of Unleavened Bread. That's what we're going to do in this sermon. Now, let's look, first of all, at where Easter came from. Judges chapter 2, Easter has a very ancient history. Judges chapter 2. A lot of people will tell you that Easter is started in the New Testament because Jesus Christ was resurrected on Easter Sunday morning. We have Easter sunrise services, and they fit 3 days and nights. The prophecy he gave about the time he would be in the tomb, which we're not going to cover in the sermon. They try to squeeze 3 days and nights into Good Friday afternoon, when he died, supposedly, to Sunday morning. And I have a lot of training in math, and I can't do that. I can't squeeze in 3 days and nights from Friday at sundown till Sunday morning. I can get in there about half of that, but I can't get in the 3 days and three nights. That's what the world will tell you, the religions will tell you, that it came from when Christ was resurrected. But it actually came out of Babylon, and we're going to show that. Judges chapter 2. And in Judges chapter 2, we're going to read in verse 8. And please forgive me, but we're going to be doing a lot of reading. You're a very smart congregation, so this should not bother you at all. So Judges chapter 8, I'm sorry, chapter 2, verse 8. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old, and they buried him. Verse 10, when all that generation, the one that knew Joshua and all the miracles that had happened in the crossing of the Red Sea and, you know, wandering in the wilderness and all of that, when all that generation had been gathered to their fathers died, another generation arose after them, which did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. And they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. And they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord, and they served the Baals and the Ashtaroths. Notice what they were serving, the gods and deities. And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel. So he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. These were fulfillments of prophecies given in the book of Leviticus. Verse 16, and it talks about God raising up judges who delivered them out. Verse 17, and they would not listen to their judges or their champions or their heroes, but they played the harlot with other gods. When it says play the harlot, that's literal. They had orgies to these deities. So it's not, you know, something symbolic. They were playing the harlot. They turned quickly from the way in which the fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do so. And when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord had pity by their groanings because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. So ancient Israel left the religion, so to speak, of Joshua and the patriarchs after a generation. And they began to serve the Baals and the Ashtaroths. And because of this, God was extremely upset with them. He was very, very upset with them. Easter is an ancient pagan festival. You get out the Encyclopedia Britannica and look up the history of Easter. Easter is an ancient pagan festival which is centered around the Great Earth Mother Goddess. The Great Earth Mother Goddess is sometimes referred to as the Queen of Heaven. In ancient literature, she's often referred to as the Madonna, the Mother and Child. It involves a death and resurrection, depending on your religion that you're looking at, sometimes a reincarnation of her husband or of her lover. In different cases, the husband, the reincarnated dead god deity, is also the son or the half-brother of the goddess. Depends on which culture you're looking at. Some of these cultures and some of the gods that are involved in all this are, for example, the Assyrians. They had Semiramis and Ninus. The Babylonians had Ishtar and Tammuz. Egypt, we had Isis and Osiris. Syria, we had Astarte and Baal, or Baal, sometimes called Marduk. You've heard of Venus. Remember that old song, Venus, Goddess of Love? Mm-hmm. Venus. And we had Adonis. They were the same people in different names. We've got George and we've got Jorge. We've got Juan and we've got John. It's the same people, different cultures, different language. In Greece, Aphrodite and Adonis. And in Rome, Kibble and Adonis. So there were different names for these gods. Now, King Nimrod had a queen, and her name was Semiramis. Semiramis sometimes is called Easter, sometimes it's called Ishtar, and Tammuz was the son of Nimrod and Semiramis. And they were actually worshipped in ancient pagan rites. You had the father, you had the mother, and you had the son. There was a trinity that was involved. And they worshiped this Trinity as the Godhead. Now, depending on which version of the story you're looking at, you know, who was involved and what culture, the legend of Easter goes something like this. I'm going to give you the Egyptian version. The goddess Isis had married her brother Osiris. Osiris was later killed by Set. Now, if you look at ancient history, Shem, remember Shem, the righteous son of Noah? He was involved in killing some of these deities that were actually existing as real people. He was later killed by Set or Shem. Set or Shem sent pieces of his body all over the land of Egypt. The reason he did this is they didn't want the body being in one place and people then worshiping it. So he cut his body up and sent it all over the place. He separated the body. Isis set out on a journey to recover the pieces. That was the wife. Having found them, she tried to bring them back to life. She mourned for 2 nights and 1 day. You remember the Bible, it talks about mourning for Tammuz? So she mourns for 2 nights and 1 day. You can actually get 2 nights and 1 day between Friday afternoon and Sunday morning, if you understand what I'm saying. In spite of her great power, she only partially succeeded and was allowed only 1 night with her husband. Horus, the sun god, was born. The following morning at sunrise, Osiris rose to take his place in the heavens. You've heard of Orion the Hunter, a constellation up in the sky. His father is the sun god Ra. He is now immortal. He became the ruler of the underworld, judging the dead. The son Horus is the son of God, or the sun god, and was worshipped. You remember in the ancient, in the temple of God, when it had become paganized, they had chariots to the sun and horses to the sun in there, because they believed that the sun was pulled on a chariot by horses. And so they had horses to these gods. This is a story that is based on fact. Parts of this actually happened. Semiramis was the original so-called mother goddess. She was married to Nimrod. She became queen of Assyria by marrying King Ninus, which was one of several of her husbands. She was a very interesting woman. Like I said, she led a very interesting life, if you can follow me. She was accused of murdering him. His resurrection into the heavens was a way to explain Ninus's disappearance. So she kills her husband for various reasons, and then to explain his death and disappearance, she said, "Oh, he has ascended up into the heavens. Look, there he is, as Orion." She declared Ninus a god, and therefore, if she was married to the god, then she was the wife of a god. She became a god and therefore worthy of worship. She had an illegitimate son. Remember I said she led an interesting life? She had an illegitimate son who was claimed was fathered by the dead Ninus. This mother-child worship became popular. The Great False Church later utilized it. You wonder why the Great False Church was able to inculcate mother and child worship into what they did? It came out of Semiramis and what happened to her. Tradition says that Semiramis's lovers were buried all over Western Asia. Parts everywhere. The son of Horus, was born on December the 25th. 40 weeks back brings us to the vernal or the spring equinox of March 21. If you're involved with women being pregnant, you know that you've got 41 weeks or 40 weeks or the 9 months. So if you go back from December the 25th to when he was born, and you come to the spring or the vernal equinox. That's obviously, if he was born on December 25th, then he was conceived sometime during the spring equinox. This is a time that the ancient celebrations of the death and the resurrection of these pagan gods took place. They took place in the spring. Now, I want you to think about a great religion that is based on Babylon the Great, that has a great city that is built on seven hills like Babylon is, that is universal, which is what the word Catholic means, all right? And this great religion, universal religion, has adopted customs out of paganism, one of them being the Madonna, the mother and child, the death of one of its gods and its resurrection a day and a half later, right around the time of spring. So keep that in mind. It was also the time used for the dating of Easter. You think that Easter was dated at this time because of the death of Jesus Christ. It had nothing to do with the death of Jesus Christ. That was an excuse by which they put that date on it. Some cultures had a time period of fasting or weeping for Tammuz, where because they were in some kind of fast, they would give up eating certain kinds of food. You with me? All right. The Great False Church, which the Bible calls Mystery Babylon, observes Lent during this time period. I've got Catholic friends giving up Coca-Colas. They've given up sweets. They've given up dancing. They've given up movies. They've given up TV. They've given up whatever it happens to be, which I'm sure is all biblical. For those of you listening on tape, I rolled my eyes. The actual rites, our mourning for Isis, lasted one day and two nights. Then he was resurrected. The Good Friday, Easter Sunday tradition is one day and two nights. Christ said 3 days and three nights. The ancient pagan traditions about the resurrection became Easter, and the pagan traditions about the birth became Christmas. And so we have this religious system that's based on incest, idolatry, seduction, and murder. You may think I'm being a little melodramatic, but let's look at what the Bible says about some of these characters. Genesis chapter 10. Now, in order for us to look at the days of unleavened bread, we're going to compare them with the false system that I've been reading about. So you can look at them and compare the two. Genesis chapter 10, verse 8. Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. The word before is kind of implies that, like, here we have God, the Lord, and then Nimrod's before him. That's not what it means. The word before means instead of. So he was a mighty hunter who put himself in the place of God, is how it should read. And reading in verse 10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, where we get the word Babylon from. Erech, Akkad, and Cana in the land of Shinar. You read about the prophecies in the Old Testament, especially Jeremiah 50, and talks about Babylon, and it's tied into what land? Land of Shinar. From that land, he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, various other cities that he built. So Babylon came out of Nimrod. He was a mighty hunter who put himself in the place of God. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read to you what some of the encyclopedias say about some of these characters. This is Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, published in 1910. I'm not going to read it all to you, just parts of it. It says Nimrod. Nimrod is only mentioned in three passages in the Bible. In Micah, verse 6, Assyria is called the land of Nimrod. And in 1 Chronicles 1:10, quotes a portion of the third. The most important reference is Genesis 10, 8 through 12. In Genesis 10, 8, as Jabal was the inventor of music, so Nimrod was the first warrior, the first hunter. He became a mighty hunter before Yahweh, so it is said, a mighty hunter before Yahweh like Nimrod, the first builder of cities and rulers of a widespread dominion. The beginnings of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, and then read some of the other things I just read. The general statement that Assyria was was originally an offshoot and a dependence of Babylon is substantially in accordance with Assyrian and Babylonian authority. So in other words, the fact that Babylon and Assyria were joined and linked together, it's a common knowledge in some of the scholarly works. A Nimrod has been identified with Merodach, the god of Babylon. He has also been identified with Gilgamesh. You remember the Noah story? And there's a Babylonian version of this, a Gilgamesh epic. That's Nimrod. The hero of the epic, which contains a Babylonian deluge story. He's identified with various historical kings of Babylon, with Orion. The name frequently occurs in Egyptian documents. The story of Nimrod is sometimes conjectured to be of Egyptian origin. Some support might be obtained from this view by supposing Cush in verse 8 to be Ethiopia, as in verse 6. It is possible that Nimrod is the most ancient form of the name. So Nimrod has a long history. You remember Cush and Ham? Cush and Ham is where we get Egypt from. In the land of Ham, miracles were performed by Moses. So Ham and Cush and Nimrod were all Egyptian. This is Semiramis. This is not the Bible, brethren. This is just an encyclopedia. This is, once again, the ninth edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Ninus, the founder of Nineveh, and his great spouse Semiramis. So according to legend, we have the city Nineveh. You remember Jonah, who was swallowed by the whale, or the great fish, for 3 days and three nights? Where was he sent? He was sent to Nineveh to tell Nineveh to repent. And he was upset that Nineveh repented. It made him angry. And Nineveh was founded by Nimrod, or Ninus, and his great spouse Semiramis. Let's see. Ninus died, and Semiramis, succeeding to his power, traversed all parts of the empire, erecting great cities, especially Babylon, and stupendous monuments or opening roads through savage mountains. At length, after a reign of 42 years, she was delivered up. She delivered up her kingdom to her son Nias and disappears. Or, according to what seems to be the original form of the story, was turned into a dove and was thenceforth worshipped as a deity. What religion worships God as a dove? The plot thickens. But it is around the figure of Semiramis that all the real interest of the legend gathers. Nor can she be an arbitrary creation of a poet, for it is certain that her name was popularly connected with many famous places and monuments. The works of Semiramis are pointed out throughout almost the whole continent, earthworks bearing her name, walls and strongholds, aqueducts and stair-like roads over mountains, canals, roads, and bridges. She was a builder. Ultimately, every stupendous work of antiquity on Iran seems to have been ascribed to her. Let me read you some more here. Armenian tradition regarding her as a founder, these facts are to be explained by observing that in her birth, as well as in her disappearance from earth, Semiramis clearly appeared not as a mere woman, but as a great goddess. It says she was miraculously brought up by doves. And again, she is finally transformed into a dove. And therefore, the Assyrians pay divine honors to this bird. The Assyrians pay divine honors to this bird, which is the same as Babylon. So the Babylonians worship the dove as a deity. Semiramis, therefore, is a dove goddess associated with Dretko, the fish goddess. Oh. So what religion worships the dove, and what religion worships the fish? I remember when I was growing up in a great false church, on Fridays we ate fish. You ever wondered why? But the Semitic dove goddess is Ishtar or Astarte. So her name in the Semitic religion was Ishtar Astarte. What were the people in Joshua's time, what were they worshiping? The Astaroths, which is plural for Astarte. So they were worshiping the Astarte goddess. Is Ishtar Astarte, the great goddess of Assyria, Babylonia, and the irresistible charms of Semiramis, her sexual excesses, and other features of the legend all bear out the view that she is primarily a form of Astarte, and so fittingly conceived as a great queen of heaven. So she was called the queen mother of heaven. She had a child on her lap often because the child was born to her because she had had relations with a god. She was worshipped as a dove. She was raised by doves. At her going away, she turned into a dove. And she's associated with another goddess that was a fish god. Sounds kind of interesting to me, all of this that's going on. Now, what we're going to do now is we're going to look at some of the scholarly works and what they say about this religion during the time of the Israelites. During the time of Joshua, the Judges, Kings and Chronicles, things like that. Now, let me give you a little bit of background here. We often think that, man, if I lived back in the times of the kings of ancient Israel, that would be a very religious and holy time because we had all these Israeli kings and all these kings of Judah, and we would see firsthand all the things that are going on. What you would actually see is you would see a nation that was in abject paganism. They would be going up to the mountains to have orgies because the fields had to be fertilized and the fields had to produce. And in order for the fields to produce, you had to please the sexual goddesses because they're the ones that made things increase. And so therefore, you went on to up to the mountains where there were, how do I say this? This is a church service. There were rude pillars pointing to the sky under which they had their orgies. And God said, he condemned them for all this. And he said, you've played the harlot up in the mountains, up in the high places. And they did this. They had their orgies out up in the high places. So the gods looking down could see them. And that's why they did that. This is what it says in Haley's Bible Handbook. Book you probably have at home in your bookcase. You remember Abraham. Where did Abraham come from? Ur of the Chaldees. Remember that? Come out of her. Come out and I'm going to show you a new place. Ur was in Babylonia. And the Babylonians had many gods and goddesses. This is Haley's Bible Handbook. They were worshippers of fire, the sun, the moon, the stars, and various forces of nature. Nimrod, who had exalted himself against God in the building of the Tower of Babel, was ever afterwards recognized as a chief Babylonian deity. Marduk, another name for Marduk is Molech. Marduk was a common form of his name, later being identical with Baal. Ancient Israel worshipped who? The Baals. Shamush was the name of the sun god. Sin, the moon god, was the principal deity of Ur, Abraham's city. Sin's wife was called Ningal. We read about her earlier. The moon goddess of Ur. She had many names and was worshipped in every city as a mother goddess. You remember Paul being somewhere in Greece? And he got into trouble with the idol makers because he said that Diana, the goddess of the Ephesians, was not a true god. And all the idol makers made a lot of money making these idols. And so they all got an uproar because Paul is telling them these idols are nothing. This was another name for Semiramis. Diana, goddess of the Ephesians, was a form of Semiramis. She was shown with dozens of breasts on her. You can see her in various pictures in various books. Her commonest name in Babylonia was Ishtar. She was a deification of the sex passion. Her worships required licentiousness. Sacred prostitution in connection with her sanctuaries was a universal custom among the women of Babylon. If you lived in the time of the kings of Israel, and you lived in the time of the judges, and you lived in the time of Joshua. You were a descendant of Abraham, and Abraham's religion, because it came from God, taught you to be sexually pure, taught you to be moral, taught you the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery, taught you all these things. And then competing with you in the area, all the people around you, because they didn't drive out all the ites, all the people around you were keeping this religion, this false religion. Part of the tenets of the religion were that if you were a man, you had to go up to the temple every so often to partake of the temple prostitutes. And if you were a woman, you had to go into the temple and serve as a prostitute so often. So you had, and then you had to be involved in all kinds of orgies. I'm trying to not be too graphic here. But this is what the Bible says was happening. And so you got this moral religion, and it's competing with this religion where anything goes. That's why they were seduced by the religion. That's why God said, don't be ensnared, don't be seduced, don't be led astray, don't do the things that the people that are around you are doing, because it's going to lead you into trouble. And because of all these things, then God sent the nation into captivity. In connection, this is still talking about the idolatry of Abraham's day in the book of Haley's Bible Handbook. It says, in connection with her temple were charming retreats or chambers where her priestesses entertained male worshipers in disgraceful ceremonies. I'll let you figure out what was going on. In addition to these prostitute priestesses, every maid or wife or widow had to officiate at least once in her lifetime in these rites. Here's another article out of Haley's Bible Handbook. This is under the note Baal worship. Do you remember Jericho? And you remember Jericho, and they marched around Jericho on the days of unleavened bread? And they marched around it, and on the last day they blew the trumpet seven times and the walls fell down? And all the walls fell down except for the part where Rahab the harlot lived? Why did the walls fall down? This is under Baal worship. The Oriental Institute excavating at Megiddo, which is near Samaria, found in the strata of Ahab's time the ruins of a temple of Astarte, goddess wife of Baal. Just a few steps from this temple was a cemetery where many jars were found containing the remains of infants who had been sacrificed in this temple. Prophets of Baal and Astarte were official murderers of little children. You know, you read about Elijah sacrificing the priests of Baal, get them all and kill them, and you say, oh, God was so, he was really, this was terrible that he did this to these priests. Well, these priests would kill the children. Now, where do you think these children came from? If you're running around worshiping sex, what's going to be one of the things that happens? How do you dispose of the children that are born? Well, we'll make it part of our religion. You remember Molech? Molech had his arms outstretched. He was a brass statue. Inside of his belly was a fire. The band would play. They would throw the kid onto the arms. He would burn up, fall in, and burn up. At Jericho, they would take the bodies of these children and they would plaster them into the walls of the wall of the city. Because if they took these bodies and they plastered them into the walls of the city, the goddesses and the gods would protect the city. And that's why the walls came down, because they were full of these children that had been plastered into the wall. So when you read the Bible about, you know, some of the kings of Israel offering their children up to Molech, or you read about Solomon, and he had high places to Molech. These were the gods that we're talking about. This is also under Haley's Bible Handbook. This is Canaanite religion, about the time that we're talking about. And then you wonder why God said, you go in there and you kill everybody. And we think God is being a little, isn't he being a little rough with things? Canaanite religion. God's express command to Israel was to destroy or drive out the Canaanites. And Joshua went at it in dead earnest, God himself helping with mighty miracles. In reality, God did it. In excavations at Gezer, McAllister of the Palestine Exploration Fund found in the Canaanite stratum, so they found in this layer of dirt from the time period of the time of Canaanite, which had preceded Israeli occupation of about 1500 BC, the ruins of a high place, which had been a temple in which they worshipped their god Baal and their goddess Astarte or Ashtaroth. It was an enclosure 150 by 120 feet, surrounded by a wall, open to the sky, where the inhabitants held their religious festival. Within the walls were 10 rude stone pillars. I'll let you imagine what those are. 5 to 11 feet high before the sacrifices were offered. Under the debris in this high place, McAllister found a great number of jars containing the remains of children who had been sacrificed to Baal. The whole area proved to be a cemetery for newborn babies. Another horrible practice was what they call foundation sacrifices. When a house was to be built, a child would be sacrificed and his body built into the walls to bring good luck to the rest of the family. Many of these were found in Gezer. They have been found also at Megiddo, Jericho, and other places. Also in this high place, under the rubbish, McAllister found enormous quantities of images and plaques of Astarte with rudely exaggerated sex organs, pornography, designed to foster sensual feelings. So, Canaanites worship, this is the gods that we're talking about, that the children of Israel were worshiping, that was involved with Astarte from where Easter came from. So Canaanites worship by immoral indulgence as a religious rite in the presence of their gods, and then by murdering their firstborn children as a sacrifice to these same gods. It seems that in large measure, the land of Canaan had become a sort of Sodom and Gomorrah on a national scale. Do we wonder any longer why God commanded Israel to exterminate the Canaanites? Did a civilization of such abominable filth and brutality have any right to exist any longer? It is one of history's examples of the wrath of God against the wickedness of nations. Archaeologists who dig in the ruins of Canaanite cities wonder that God did not destroy them sooner than he did. And that's what was going on at that time. Let me read you what it says about Ishtar. This is out of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and excuse me for reading so much, but I want you to see that this is all common knowledge. Ishtar, in Mesopotamian religion, goddess of war and of sexual love. You remember Venus, goddess of love and war? That was her. Ishtar is an Akkadian counterpart of the West Semitic god Astarte. Inanna is an important goddess in the Sumerian pantheon. She came to be identified with Ishtar. In the figure of Inanna, several traditions seem to have been combined. She is sometimes a daughter of the sky god An, sometimes a wife, and another myth, she is a daughter of Nanna, goddess of the moon. Astarte, or Ishtar, and you know, in Babylonian, when you pronounce the word Ishtar, it's pronounced Easter. Same word, same pronunciation. Ishtar's primary legacy from the Sumerian tradition is the role of fertility figure. She evolved, however, into a more complex character surrounded in myth by death and disaster. A goddess of contradictory connotations and forces, fire and fire quenching, rejoicing and tears, fair play and enmity. The Akkadian Ishtar is also, to a great extent, an astral deity associated with the planet Venus, with the sun god and Sin, moon god. She forms a secondary astral triad. You know what it means when they say a secondary astral triad? It means the astronomical trinity that's up in the sky. In this manifestation, her symbol is a star with 6, 8, or 16 rays within a circle. As goddess of Venus, delighting in bodily love, you figure what that means? As goddess of Venus, delighting in bodily love, Ishtar was the protectress of prostitutes and the patroness of the alehouse. Part of her cult worship probably included temple prostitution, and her cult center, Erech, was a city filled with courtesans and harlots. Her popularity was universal in the Middle East. You wonder why? And in many centers of worship, she probably subsumed numerous local goddesses. In later myth, she is known as the Queen of the Universe, taking on the powers of Anan, Enlil, and Enlil. Queen of the Universe, sometimes called Queen Mother. Let me read you. I just got a few more to read you. This is Astarte. I was talking to you about Ishtar. Now I'm going to read to you about Astarte. What did the children of Israel get into trouble for? Worshipping the Ashtaroth, which is the plural for Astarte, and worshipping the Baals, sometimes spelled B-A-A-L and sometimes spelled B-E-L. The word Baal means priest. I'll get to that in a minute. Let me read you something else. Astarte, Encyclopedia Britannica. Astarte was also spelled, and it gives a various spelling, great goddess of the ancient Near East, chief deity of Tyre, Sidon, important Mediterranean seaports, a lot of sailors there. Hebrew scholars now feel that the goddess Astarte, mentioned so often in the Bible, is a deliberate compilation of the Greek name Astarte and the Hebrew word boshet, which means shame, indicating the Hebrew contempt for a cult. Ashtaroth, the plural form of the goddess's name in Hebrew, became a general term denoting goddesses in paganism. King Solomon married foreign wives. It says, quote, went after Astarte, the goddess of the Sidonians, 1 King 11:5. Later, the cult places to Astarte were destroyed by Josiah. You remember the reforms of King Josiah? Astarte or Ashtaroth is the queen of heaven to whom the Canaanites had burned incense and poured libations. Astarte was worshipped as Astarte in Egypt and among the Hittites as well as in Canaan. Her Akkadian counterpart was Ishtar. Later she became assimilated with the Egyptian deity Isis and Hathor and in the Greco-Roman world with Aphrodite, Artemis, and Juno, all aspects of the Great Mother. So depending on which one you read, let me read you what it says about Tammuz, of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Tammuz, god of fertility, embodying the powers of new life in nature. The cult of Tammuz, you remember people weeping for Tammuz, we're going to read about that in a minute. Making cakes for the Queen of Heaven. The cult of Tammuz centered around two yearly festivals, one celebrating his marriage to the goddess Inanna, or Ishtar, the other lamenting his death at the hands of demons from the netherworld. During the Third Dynasty in the city of Yuma, the modern city of Jakarta, the marriage of the god was dramatically celebrated in February-March. The texts relate that in the marriage rite, the king actually took on the identity of the god, and thus by consummating the marriage with a priestess, incarnating the goddess, magically fertilized all of nature for the year. So they had a public orgy, because the king took on the nature of the sun god, there was a priestess, they had public sex, and this was supposed to help the crops grow. The celebrations in March and April that marked the death of the god also seem to have been dramatically performed. You know, we have a problem with our children going to R-rated movies. Think about what it would be like to live there and you've got these celebrations taking place and all of the people are going to see them. We think, oh, things have never been this bad. You have no idea, brother. Eventually, a variety of originally independent fertility gods seem to have been identified with Tammuz. A later important fusion was the merger of Tammuz and Damu, the fertility god, who probably represented the power in the sap to rise in trees and plants in spring. So it goes. It has all kinds of things about these goddesses. Let's. I'm finished with most of the reading. Let's look at what the Bible says. Now that you know about Tammuz, now that you know about Nina, now that you know about Aphrodite, now that you know about Baal, now that you know about Semiramis, now that you know about cakes being offered to her, now that you know about the high places, now that you know about the statues and the figures and the Ashtaroth poles that are mentioned in the scriptures, now that you know about these things, let's read about them in the Bible. Jeremiah chapter 44. Jeremiah. Jeremiah 44. And in Jeremiah 44, I don't have time to read it, but mine has a title. It says, Israelites will be punished in Egypt. And it talks about what was going to happen. Verse 3. This is what God says he's going to do to them. And why? Because of their wickedness, which they have committed to provoke me to anger, in that they went to burn incense and to serve other gods, whom they did not know, nor you, nor your fathers. However, I have sent to you all my servants and prophets, rising early and sending them, saying, oh, do not do this abominable thing that I hate. But they did not listen or incline their ears or turn from their wickedness to burn incense to other gods. Let's notice verse 8. In that you provoked me to wrath with the works of your hands, burning incense to other gods in the land of Egypt. Remember what Ham was and Cush? Land of Egypt. Let me kind of skim here. Verse 15. Then all the men who knew that their wives had burned incense to other gods, with all the women who stood by, a great multitude, and all the people who dwelt in the land of Egypt, answered Jeremiah. So Jeremiah is telling them that God's going to do this because you're burning incense. So you've got all these people that are burning incense, and they said what to Jeremiah? Verse 16. As for the word that you have spoken to us in the name of the Lord, we're not going to listen to you. But we will certainly do whatever has gone out of our own mouth to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven and to pour out drink offerings to her as we have done, we and our fathers, our kings and our princes, in the streets of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem. For when we did this, we were very blessed. Verse 18, but since we stopped burning incense to the Queen of Heaven, things have really gone bad, they say. Verse 19, the women also said, and when we burned incense to the Queen of Heaven and poured out our drink offerings to her, did we make cakes for her to worship her and to pour out our drink offerings to her without her husband's permission? In other words, the wives were doing this because husbands let them. Verse 23. This is Jeremiah's response to them. Because you have burned incense and because you have sinned against the Lord and have not obeyed the voice of the Lord or walked in his laws, in his statutes, or in his testimony, therefore this calamity has happened to you as at this day. You've been sent into captivity. Children of Israel had been taken into captivity. They had gone to Babylon and Assyria. Some of them had gone down to Egypt. They'd come out of captivity. They had barely missed going into captivity. So they're in Egypt. And instead of saying, you know, what have we done wrong to make things right so that God will bless us, they continue to burn incense to the false gods. Verse 25. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, saying, you and your wives have spoken with your mouths and fulfilled with your hands, saying, we will surely keep our vows that we have made to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven and to pour out drink offerings to her. You will surely keep your vows before them. He's saying, in other words, yes, I understand that you're going to continue to do this. Yep, you will do this. Verse 26, because you've decided you're going to do this, Verse 26. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, I have sworn by my great name, says the Lord, that my name shall no more be named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt, saying, the Lord God lives here. I want to remove my name from here. And he goes on to talk about what's going to happen, brethren, to the children of Israel that were doing this. Notice Jeremiah chapter 7. Oh, if we lived in the time of Jeremiah, that would be a great biblical time. Well, you'd be living in a nation that for hundreds of years, brethren, had been doing this. Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7. And we're going to read in verse 14. Therefore, I will also do to this house, which is called by my name, in which you trust, and to this place which I gave to you and to your fathers, as I have done to Shiloh. And I will cast you out of my sight, as I have cast all of your brethren, the whole posterity of Ephraim. Therefore, do not pray for this people, nor lift up a cry or pray for them, nor make intercessions for me, for I will not hear you. Does God hear everyone's prayers? No. Some people are so abject in paganism that God doesn't listen to them. Especially when he sent Jeremiah to tell them to change. Verse 17. Did you not see what they do in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem? The children gather wood, the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead dough to make cakes for the Queen of Heaven, and they pour out drink offerings to other gods that they may provoke me to anger. So God was going to punish them for doing this. Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel chapter 8. I had to tell you about Tammuz and about Astarte and about all these characters by reading to you about them so that when you read them in the Bible here, you'll understand the background. Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 5. Then he said to me, Son of man, lift up your eyes now towards the north. So I lifted my eyes towards the north, and there north of the altar was an image of jealousy in the entrance. So in Jerusalem, there's this image that's making God jealous. Furthermore, he said to me in verse 6, Son of man, do you see what they are doing, the great abominations that the house of Israel commits here to make me go away from my sanctuary? Now turn again, and you're going to see even worse things, he says. Verse 7, so he brought me to the door of the court. This is a court of the temple. And I looked, and there was a hole in the wall. Then he said to me, Son of man, dig into the wall. And when I dug into the wall, there was a door. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked abominations which they are doing here. So he sees his vision. He's transported to the temple. He sees the wall of the temple. He sees a covering. He digs the covering off. He sees a door. They say, open the door and look at what's going on inside. Verse 8, 10, so I went and saw, and there every sort of creeping thing, abominable beast, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around on the walls. This was in the temple. And there stood before them 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel, and in their midst stood Jahazian, the son of Shaphan. Each man had a censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. Then he said to me, Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the room of his idols, for they say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. And he said, turn again, and you will see greater abominations that they are doing. So he brought me to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house. This is a temple. And to my dismay, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. You know what it means to weep for Tammuz? It means that they were fasting. Then he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Turn again, you will see greater abominations. So he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house, and there at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men, with their backs towards the temple of the Lord, and their faces towards the east, and they were having sunrise services, worshiping the sun towards the east. What religion do you know, brethren, that has tomorrow at about 6:45, 7 o'clock, are going to have sunrise services to a Babylonian deity named Ishtar, pronounced Easter. Verse 17, and he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? It is a trivial thing. Now, they don't even think it's anything wrong with this. It's a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here, for they have filled the land with violence. Then they have returned to provoke me to anger. Indeed, they put the branch to their nose. And he talks about what's going to happen to them. 1 Kings 11. 1 Kings 11. The time of Israel and the time of Judah and the times that we're reading about, except for a few bright little moments, were times of abject poverty. I mean, abject paganism. 1 Kings chapter 11. Talking about Solomon. Verse 11. Verse 1. King Solomon loved lots of foreign wives. God said, don't make yourself a harem of foreign wives. Why? Because they're going to bring in their gods. So he had the Moabites, the Ammonites, a bunch of ites. Verse 2. From the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry. They're going to turn your heart away. Solomon clung to these in lust. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For as he got older, his wives turned his heart to other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtaroth, same God I've been talking about, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as did his father David. Solomon built a high place for Chemosh. This was Molech. The abomination of Moab on the hill that is in the east of Jerusalem. And from Molech, another name, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the suburbs of Jerusalem have been turned into pagan temples to pacify Solomon's wives. 2 Kings. 2 Kings. Second Kings. We're going to read in 2 Kings chapter 22. And we're going to skim over these two chapters very quickly. 2 Kings chapter 22. Josiah began to reign. Verse 23. He did that which was right. Verse 2. Verse 4 and verse 5 and verse 6. They began to restore the temple. Verse 8. They find the book of the law. Verse 10, the king reads in the book of the law the things that we have been reading, because that's what's in the law, what we've been reading. Verse 16, the Lord says, I'm going to bring calamity on this place because of all the sins. Chapter 23, Josiah decides to restore the true worship. Notice that this is the temple, brethren, that we're talking about. This is the temple we're talking about. Notice what had happened to the temple. What would you think if you went to Capitol Hill in Washington and there was a statue of Lenin and Mao Zedong, where the statue of President Washington and President Lincoln used to be? They took the image of Lincoln, you know, standing on that chair, looking out over the causeway. They took that statue out and they put one of Mao Zedong. What would you think? You'd think that is sacrilegious. Verse 2 of chapter 23. And the king went up to the house of the Lord with all the men of Judah. And they read what was going on. Verse 4. And the king commanded the high priest and all the rest of the people to bring out of the temple of the Lord all the articles that were made for Baal, for Asherah, and for all the host of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem. Verse 5. Then he removed the idolatrous priests. So there were idolatrous priests who were living in the temple. He removed the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense on the high places in the cities of Judah and the places all around Jerusalem, and those who burn incense to Baal, to the sun, to the moon, to the constellations, and to all the hosts of heaven. And he brought out the wooden image from the house of the Lord. Remember, there was a wooden image that was causing jealousy we read about earlier? This is it. And he brought out the wooden image in verse 6. Ground into ashes. Verse 7. Then he tore down the ritual booths of the perverted persons. That's what it says. To whom the house that were in the house of the Lord, where the woman wove hangings for the wooden images. In this temple, there were, how do I say it? Chambers for those of you who were heterosexual. And there were chambers for those of you who were not. So they had all kinds of priests who would service you depending on what your flavor was. Okay? That's what it means. Notice what it says in chapter 7, verse 7. Notice the little number there. Reference that and see what it says to you. Those practicing sodomy and prostitution and religious rites. Can't get any plainer, brother. Notice verse 9. Talks about the priests of the high places. Verse 11. He removed the horses there. The chariots of fire in verse 11, last part. He removed the altars on the roof. I don't have time to read all of you. This, verse 13. Then the king defiled the high places which were in the east of Jerusalem, which were on the south of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon, king of Israel, had built for Ashtaroth, the abominations of the Sidonians, for Shemeth, and for Milcom. These places of worship were still there hundreds of years later when Josiah came to power. He got rid of all of them. And I'm not going to read you everything else, but he cleaned house. He cleaned house. Acts chapter 19. Acts chapter 19. And notice what it says in verse 23. There was a riot at Ephesus. What was a riot? Why was there a riot? And about that time in verse 23, there arose a great commotion about the way. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Diana. Mine has a little rendering, a little note there by the word Diana. When you reference that in verse 24, it talks about Artemis, another name for Venus. Brought no small profit to the craftsmen. And then you can read the rest of it, but there was a riot because Paul was telling them that this was an idol. And he said, if they give up this religion, we're not going to have any more idols to make, and we're not going to be able to make money. And so here we have a New Testament reference to some of these gods we've been talking about. Easter customs, real quickly. The egg was a sacred symbol among the Babylonians. If you had a religion that was based on fertility and sex, then you think the egg would be important? Yes. Hot cross buns. It's a great delicacy during Easter. They put a cross on it. You remember the women making cakes for the Queen of Heaven? Easter rabbits. Why rabbits? Rabbits are very prolific. They're very fertile. Why fish? Fish give off thousands of eggs. They're very fertile. Lent, a modern version of weeping for Tammuz. In the Babylonian Tammuz, the husband of Semiramis is killed by a wild boar. He was 40. One day of fasting for each day of the year of his life. What does God say are some of the days we should be keeping? Let's go to Leviticus. You can't find any of these religious worldly religious observances, you can't find any of them in the Bible. You can find a lot about them being condemned, but you can't find any of them in the Bible. We're commanded to worship Ishtar, Easter, or Astarte. As a matter of fact, we're told to do the opposite. You can, however, find many places where the Bible commands you to keep his days. Leviticus. Now, here we have clear commands, brethren, in the Old Testament on what days to keep. You have to ask yourself, why aren't people doing them? Chapter 23, verse 2, these are the feasts of the Lord. Verse 3, the Sabbath. Verse 5, the Passover, which we just observed. Verse 6, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which we are in the middle of, or at the beginning of. Those are the days that we should be keeping. Now, a lot of people tell you, oh, well, see, those were the Old Testament days. Those have all been done away with. There's no mention of these days in the New Testament. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians, chapter 5. Now, I'm not going to get into all the little side issues, but there was a problem going on in the church at Corinth. And this problem was likened to leaven. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And a little sin leavens the whole church. That's what he was saying. But notice in verse 6, your glorying, this is 1 Corinthians 5, 6, your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. In other words, they were physically unleavened, and they were even spiritually unleavened, so to speak. For indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with the old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Now let me ask you a question, brethren. It says that we're supposed to keep the feast. Therefore, Paul says, let us keep the feast. Question to ask is, which one? Well, look at the context. It talks about leavening. It talks about our Passover has already been sacrificed for us. It talks about us being unleavened. And it talks about putting leaven out of our life and putting on the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Obviously, brethren, the references are all to the days of unleavened bread. I could show you that we're supposed to keep atonement. I could show you that we're supposed to keep the Passover out of the New Testament. I'm not going to do that. But I do want you to understand, brethren, that we are living in Babylon. I mean, make no doubts about it. We are living in Babylon. And when you go back out into the world, it's very easy to get carried away with all of the festivities that are going on. And the thing that you need to ask yourself is, how does God, when God thinks about Easter, what does he think? He's thinking about the things I just read you, because God has a good memory. God remembers. He remembers what happened to Israel. He remembers what happened to Judah. He remembers all the prophets he sent that were killed by these pagans. And God expects us to not keep these days. He expects us to keep the days he mentions, some of them being found in the book of Leviticus. So are we still in Babylon? Yes, we are. Has Christ returned yet? No, he has not. Is the image still standing? Yes, it is. Are those traditions and festivities and holidays of Babylon still alive and well? Yes, they are. Are we supposed to partake of them? No, we are not. What are we supposed to do? Keep the days mentioned in the Bible.